brethren and sisters, I have now much pleasure in asking our brother Brian to lead us in the consideration of Isaiah chapter 24, dealing with the middle apocalypse.
Dear Brother David and my beloved brethren and sisters and young people, actually the term the little apocalypse is sometimes given to a series of chapters through here, chapters 24, 25, 26 and 27. We're not dealing with all those tonight, we're just dealing with the first half of chapter 24. It is a chapter of judgment. It's a chapter which is very much, as you would notice in that rendition, is speaking of the awesome nature of the judgment of God. And in that respect, my dear brothers and sisters, one is reminded of a couple of things that have happened during this last week or two which are very relevant to our own lives. One of them involves Israel and the other involves Russia. Russia first. During the last week or so, Mr. Yeltsin suffered a very serious setback. You remember that it's not more than about, would it be 6 or 9 months, since he set up the artillery against what was called the White House, against such people as Mr. Kasbutilov and Mr. Rutskoe, who were really like old time mines in Russia, and they had occupied the central place. And so in rebellion of the president, he decided that he would assert his authority, and eventually they were driven out of that place, weren't they? It was a very, very tense time in the world, as Russia looked as though it might have been on the verge of civil war. Now, 6 months later, those men have been freed from jail, and not only them, but also all those who rose up against Mr. Gorbachev in his period. So the two reforming minds, their enemies, their principal enemies, have now been liberated from the prisons. They are free, of course, as free citizens to activate as they would. And there's a great celebration in Russia because of their liberation. Now, that's a highly significant thing, my dear brothers and sisters. The situation in Russia is really, really unstable. The vote by which the parliament indicated they'd be taken from prison was overwhelming, so the articles say. From memory, it was something like about 52 to 258 or something like that. Now, it's only just a little while ago he was shooting bombs at those men and the country stood behind him. Now he's liberating them and they are free to activate as they will. They have, of course, very hard-line thoughts. And when they came forth from the prison, who do you think was at the gates of the prison to welcome them? None other than Vladimir Kirinovsky, who was there to celebrate with them with a bottle of vodka or champagne. And also he pointed to Mr. Rutskoe and he said, "You or I will be the next president of Russia." Well, it's, you know, the parliament vote would make you think that's where it's certainly going, wouldn't it? Not only that, but Mr. Yeltsin himself, in other ways, is under terrific pressure because of that. My dear brothers and sisters, we are living on a knife's edge. The other thing, in keeping with the judgments of God again, is a situation in Israel where, of course, there was a great massacre. And it would seem that the potential for that is that it would sort of drive the peace process apart because it sharpened up the feelings on both sides. And it's given an opportunity to the extreme Hamas movement of the Arabs, and of course also to those in Israel who want desperately to have peace, or the settler type people, the very arch conservative, who say we ought to follow that on. Now those settlers, those arch conservative people, they believe in the promise made to Abraham. They believe that when Moses was told to go in and get that land, he had to cleanse out the Gentiles. So, in mock imitation of that, Dr. Goldstein took his machine gun into the tomb. Now, do you know where that tomb was? These people live in a little town called Kirjath Arba. Quickly turn to Genesis 35. It really is immensely significant, some of these things. When Jacob returned from Padan Aram, we read in verse 27 of Genesis 35, Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is otherwise called Kirjath Arba, because Kirjath means city of Arba. All right? Unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron. Three names. Mamre, its old name. Kirjath Arba. Hebron, meaning fellowship, unity. These settlers came from a new settlement just outside Hebron called Kirjath Arba. That's the name they've given to their new settlement. Kirjath Arba. Right outside Hebron. And that tomb is right inside Hebron. Many of you may have been there. Some may have been to the very site. It's a very common place to visit when you visit Israel. It's not a very glorious site at all. But you know where it is? It's right smack bang over the graves of Abraham and Sarah, of Isaac and Rebekah, of Jacob and Leah. That's where those men were praying. And the whole issue is, whose land is Palestine? And there they are, praying over the tomb of Abraham, of Isaac and of Jacob, who received the promise, who in turn passed that on to Isaac, who passed it on to Jacob, and God confirmed that line of descent and inheritance. And there they are, praying over that tomb, because they say Abraham is their father as well. And so while they're in prayer, a Jew comes in and he mows them down with a machine gun and says, get out of here. This is my territory. I tell you, my dear brothers and sisters, they are electric things, aren't they? They really are. It's only from our perspective that you can see the drama of that. Man in the street, you could say, came from Kirjath Arba. They wouldn't know that from Moscow. But to us, that is incredibly significant and interesting. That over the tomb of the fathers, they are fighting to this day about whose land that is. And you know, even the Jews don't know. I had a lady during this last week who is a Jew. And all she wants is peace. And I said, really, the land belongs to the children of Abraham. She said, there's plenty of room for all of us. And she'd give that land away tomorrow if they could get peace. She happens to have children in the land. Isn't that interesting? Talk about the latter days. They're back, but trouble besets them. And as I said to her, trouble will continue to beset Israel until they return to their God. It's not by a machine gun, is it? Or by evoking Deuteronomy chapter 20, where Moses said, go into the land and remove the Gentiles. That was to Moses and to that generation. He hasn't said that to this generation, to get it like that. What they're doing by willpower. God has allowed them to go so far, but they are not a converted people. Well, very remarkable and interesting things we're living among. So we must take great cognizance that in a busy world, read up on those things, keep up with them, keep the lights burning, as we had in our last class on the class before last on the 10 virgins, in which we keep our lights burning. Now, back to our beloved book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 24. The book which means the salvation of Yah. Truly one of the most intriguing and wonderful sections of the scriptures. And we're working our way through this, and you'll probably notice that we in fact have skipped chapter 23. It's coming up, but it is a unit in itself. It'll come up after 24. 23, though, can be dealt with separately, and therefore that's what is being done. Now, in chapter 24, we start a new section, and the section runs through to the end of chapter 27. I'm just going to quickly run through that section so you can see how wonderful, how absolutely wonderful this section is. In fact, our program only brings us to the end of 26, but let's just sketch through it. In verses 1 down to verse 12 of chapter 24, we have a very great lament. It is a moving description of terrible judgment that penetrates into every aspect, into every status of society. Until verse 12, in the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. And then in the following verses, verses 13 to 16, we have something that is altogether different, is remarkably different, sitting in the middle of two sections dealing with judgment, verses 13 to 16. In that section, there are songs of praise unto Yahweh. Hard to reconcile, isn't it, with the context of thought? Why in the midst of two sections of judgment should there be a description of great songs of praise and of joy and thankfulness? Well, a remnant has been saved, and it is their songs which are heard in the land of Judah at that time. Now from verse 16 onwards then to verse 22, there is again a section, as we've intimated, of impending judgment. Halfway through verse 16. My leanness, woe unto me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. It's an inescapable ruin. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And verse 22 sees the principal elements of those that have set themselves against God, gathered together, verse 22, as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison after many days only shall they be visited. And then, falling out of all that circumstance of judgment, there is seen a time of tranquility and good and righteous government. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. Now that's a lot for a chapter, isn't it? And I suppose an inquiring mind is looking at that chapter and thinking, now how do you put all that together? What section belongs to what? That's a beautiful exercise, and we hope to partly deal with that tonight. Now looking at chapter 25. I'm doing this because I rather think that if I said to you before the class, you know, Isaiah 24, 25, you might think to yourself, oh, what are they all about, you know? Why are we spending so much time on those chapters? Are they really very interesting? Well, they really are interesting. They've got some of the most exciting passages in all of Scripture contained within them. Also, chapter 25 starts off with a note of exhortation. O Yahweh, thou art my God, I will exalt thee. I will praise thy name, for thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. It's sort of springing out of the sense of verse 23, of the last verse of chapter 24. Relief has come. A fruitful end has come. And so there's an elevation of thought. There's a review of what God has done. For thou hast made of a city an heap, of a defence city a ruin, a palace of strangers to be no city. It shall never be built. And you can notice in that there is a significant emphasis upon a city. It's not a very general description, even though the implications are general. There is nevertheless a focus in those words. And the thoughtful reader will immediately see that this in fact is a contest between two cities. At the end of chapter 24 there is a city that is now at rest and is the centre of world government. But it never used to be. It was the strong people of the nations, verse 3. The city of the terrible nations that used to occupy the seat of government, but it's been overthrown by God. Which is the book in the New Testament that has a similar story of two great cities? Indeed it is, aren't you glad? Of course it is, yes. And what are those two great cities? Rome and Jerusalem. Rome, which in the Apocalypse is sometimes described as Great Babylon. Great Babylon, see, the great city of the nations that has been at the centre of European influence for all of that period of time. And in that book, there is a gradual destruction of that city until finally it is gone and gone forever. And in its place, upon Mount Zion, is seen the 144,000 with the Lamb in glorious assumption of world power. Now this is the same story. Right here in the middle of Isaiah, we have a story which if you think through it, it's got to come to the same conclusions. Jerusalem eventually triumphs over the great city of the Gentiles and all those other cities which through the years have been in league with it. See verse 6 again. In this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined. You'll see that that's in striking contrast with a section that we're dealing with in the 24th chapter tonight, when there is no wine, no joy, there is no happiness. The joy of life has been lost. Now it has been found again. And there in verse 6 we have what I believe is the marriage supper of the Lamb. And verse 7, how critically important is that? The veil that is cast over all people is removed and they see life aright. That is to say, life is made available to them. So in verse 8, he will swallow up death in victory. He hath abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. Maybe a very accurate parallel of what we have here. That phrase being taken, isn't it, from the 2nd of Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10. Light and opportunity are made available. He will swallow up death in victory. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from off all faces. And the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth. And then verse 9 is just one of the most beautiful verses in all of the Bible. You know, it does pay to try and remember some verses. Ever set your mind to really remember some verses? Many years ago I tried to learn verse 9 by heart. Not very difficult. You go home tonight and learn that. And it's lovely to have those verses in your mind. You can use them if they're in your mind. If they're in your margin, they're okay. But if they're in your mind, you can use them, can't you? It's only what's in your mind which is useful during the day. When the Lord Jesus was confronted with temptation, what did he do? Say, look, just a minute, I'll run and get my Bible. He didn't do that at all, did he? Or he didn't say, I'll take a book down from the shelf. It was in his mind. You can only use what's in your mind. There's a very beautiful verse. It shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him, and he will save us. This is Yahweh. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. In that day, chapter 26, shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. See the point of that? What's happened to the other city in chapter 25? We have a strong city. How strong is it then? What's the state of its bricks and mortar? Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. They're grand words, aren't they? Now in the 26th chapter, Isaiah goes on to speak about his waiting. See verse 7, verse 8. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. They had been a long time waiting. See verse 9, chapter 25, the link up in thought. You see, the judgments of God are necessary. And you know, they're very helpful to us, aren't they? For if in my daily life I think to myself, well, God is coming for judgment, and he's going to dash in pieces the works of the nations, then as I'm daily working, as we're all daily working, as we're out in that same world, it helps us to have the right orientation in life, doesn't it? For if we be lost and consumed in all of the busyness of this, which is about to collapse like a pack of cards, then how foolish it is. The judgments of God shift the focus of our lives and help us to concentrate where we should be concentrating, and that which will be preserved and elevated when those judgments fall. The judgments of God are also helpful, my dear brothers and sisters, because of this. Would you serve God if it were not for them? If there was no distinction, if there was no differentiation at the end, if God was not going to make any difference between the righteous and the wicked, between the wise and the foolish, then would we serve him? We would not. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Get what you can now. This is the only life. So the judgments of God are helpful in that respect as well. God's going to make a sort out of the matters. And so we find that we must in this present time, get on the right side of his judgments. And those that have done that and waited and accepted the restraints of life and have lived toward him and can find their interests and their activities and their energy to his name, they, over the centuries of time, wait with great anxiety for the time when he will show that distinction and show his favour. Must be. The judgments of God are an integral part of the gospel. It's got to be. And so here we have a prayer for the judgments of God by Isaiah. He says, verse 11, Yahweh, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see and be ashamed for their envy at the people. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. And so in the following words, verses 12 to about 16, or verse 17 rather, he sees the end of the great lords of the Gentiles. They are dead, verse 14. They shall not live. They are deceased. They shall not rise. All of their great days are gone forever. They'll never come back. They've backed the wrong cause in life. Like as a woman, verse 17, with child that draweth near the times of her delivery, is in pain and crieth out in her pangs. So have we been in thy sight, O Yahweh. We have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth. Neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. It seemed very often that the cause of the righteous was altogether forsaken, as though they were in pangs of travail, but in fact, instead of there be a birth of a child that would bring them the thing that they looked for, there was but wind. All seemed to be vanity and vexation of spirit, without the fruit for which they had laboured. What is that fruit? It's life, isn't it? Death, swallowed up in victory. And here it is. Thy dead men, says God, answering that complaint. Thy dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. There's resurrection. One of the most beautiful statements of resurrection in all of the Old Testament. And see how that's intricately bound up with this section. He will swallow up death in victory. See? Take away all tears. Those that were dead are now singing a new life. And so, verse 21, for behold, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. And chapter 27 now sees Jerusalem and the Israel, the true Israel of God, blossoming now and taking over the world. Like, for example, in verse 6, he shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. Before, if you turn quickly to 24 and verse 13, there was but just a gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. See? Shaking of an olive tree. And as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done, there was but a remnant. But now, chapter 27 and verse 6, the theme is taken up, and the vine of Israel roots down and takes hold and bears up. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. It's a very wonderful description. And another figure of Israel that we know so well is the olive tree, isn't it? And Paul speaks of the olive branches being broken off, and they lay down there and die. And others were grafted in. Now all that figure of speech comes from this very chapter, Isaiah chapter 27. For see verse 11, verse 10, yet the defence city shall be desolate, and the habitation thereof, and the habitations forsaken, left like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall he lie down, and consume the branches together. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. See, that's what Paul's quoting in Romans 11. Fancy this, the basis of such a key chapter as Romans 11. The women come and set them on fire. For it is a people of no understanding, quoting Moses. Therefore he that made them will not have mercy on them. That's Deuteronomy 32. And he that formed them will show them no savour. So the boughs are now picked up again and they're put back on that tree that have been ready to be utterly destroyed. And so, verse 12, we have the remnant now blossoming forth into a great nation and a regenerated and purified nation. It shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, like he did in days of old, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet, the trumpet of Jubilee, the trumpet of return to their possession, like Jubilee meant, didn't it? They came back into their possession after 50 years. It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt. And Israel shall come home and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. Little apocalypse. But there you have the Lamb and the 144,000 Israel return, all in these wonderful chapters. Now, did you ever expect that such a scenario would be seen in Isaiah? You know, isn't the Bible really wonderful? When we're looking at Isaiah, we're about 1,000 years before Christ. The echoes, we're all going to go through this in detail, but you can see immediately, can't you, what's involved in the scope of those chapters. Enormous things. 1,000 years before Christ, that scope of things, that understanding was there. And the sense of it will become more and more plain to us as we go through this section. Now we return then to those opening verses. Chapter 24, verses 1 to 12. A doleful judgment impending. Behold, Yahweh maketh the earth empty and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. RSV says, he lays it waste and makes it desolate. Empty and maketh it waste. So, you know, those two words are basically right. They're actually very similar words, just interestingly. I don't know if this is at all significant, but it is just interesting that the first word is... The first word for empty is... There's a prize for anyone who would like to pronounce that properly. How would you pronounce that? Cross between a sheep and a cat, I think. And the other one is Balak. You're trying to think what that one is, aren't you? All right. It's just very interesting that they are the same words. Whether there's anything behind that, I don't know. But I suppose in the Hebrew there might have been a little bit of rhyming going on there. But the word which is rendered here, earth, that is more interesting to us. It's a very common word as far as the word for earth or land is concerned. It's the word Eretz. Now, when I was... younger, somebody said Eretz always referred to the land of Israel, but might I assure you that that is certainly not true. Eretz is just a very common word found in the scriptures in reference to land or country. So you'd have it hundreds of times: land of Egypt, land of Canaan, land of Moab, and so on. So it doesn't, just because the word is Eretz, doesn't mean to say it's Eretz Israel. We think of that because of that term, don't we? So often we hear our Jewish speakers. I remember Brother Lindsay Cahoon always used to say, didn't he? Eretz Israel. That's right. So you sort of thought, well, Eretz means the land of Israel as such, but doesn't it? It can mean that, of course. And if not otherwise specified, it may, of course, in the scriptures mean that. But it is not certainly a word that is confined to the use of Israel. If you look in the concordance, you'll find that there's just thousands of references to Eretz, or pretty well thousands. It's quite a few pages, and it refers to all kinds of lands. It then says, behold, Yahweh maketh the Eretz, the land, the earth, the country, empty. and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. Now the word translated turn it upside down, the Hebrew word has the significance of twisting it or distorting it. And one would think, you know, that's sort of descriptive of an earthquake. He turneth it upside down, to twist or distort the earth. Sounds like an earthquake, doesn't it? The Revised Standard Version says, he twists its surface. He twists its surface. And of course, there had been an earthquake in the earlier times of Isaiah, in the reign of Uzziah, the great earthquake of King Uzziah's time, which Zechariah 14 makes reference to, looking back at that time. I'll show you where the same word is used in a context you do know very well, Ezekiel chapter 21. Speaking of the throne of David, throne of Judah, verse 26, remove the diadem and take off the crown. Zedekiah was that wicked prince of Israel who was to be removed. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come. So it's a Hebrew word, ave, which has that sense of overturning it. But there's another very interesting Ave 3. There's another very interesting reference in Kings. 2 Kings chapter 21. This is in respect to Manasseh. He hath done wickedly above all that the Amorites did, verse 11, which were before him, and hath made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore thus saith the Lord God of Israel, behold, I am bringing evil, such evil upon Jerusalem and Judah, that whosoever heareth of it, both his ears shall tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. The house of Ahab was entirely removed, wasn't it? And so by the same measure would he remove the remnant of Manasseh. And I wipe Jerusalem as a man wipeth a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down, to get the other side as well. Children don't, do they? But that's what you should do. So there is the same expression, turning it upside down, used of what God was saying he would do to the kingdom of Judah. All right, so there's two other references which really are speaking about the same thing, I believe, as chapter 24 and verse 1. Not only used the same, but speaking actually of the same thing. He turneth it upside down. And then it says, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. For really, it's not the land that has sinned, is it? It's the people, the inhabitants upon that land, that have sinned. And so his objective is not some kind of judgment against the land, as though it was the transgressor, but against the inhabitants who dwelt upon that land. So, verse 1 then is a very thorough disturbance of the land. That's the implications of the prophecy. Affecting, now we find, the entire population of the land. That's the sense of verse 6. In verse 2, in a series of six little statements, it covers all the different peoples and status of the inhabitants of the land. All right, so he's going to scatter abroad the inhabitants. Verse 2, it shall be as with the people, so with the priest. So one were taught and the other were the teachers, but would make any difference. The judgment was going to come upon all the inhabitants of that land. That's one way of distinguishing. Then he says, as with the servant, so with his master. That's another way of looking at society, isn't it? There are those who were servants, there were those who were masters. The third expression, as with the maid, so with her mistress. So it didn't matter too whether it was male or whether it was female. Whether it was female slave or male slave. Female servant or female mistress or male master. Wouldn't make any difference. He's going to scatter the inhabitants thereof. Nor would it make any difference if he were well-to-do. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. Whether he's got surplus to lend or whether he's in need of more funds. His extra wealth are not going to be able to buy him out of this circumstance. And even if he has little, his littleness and obscurity will not also allow him to escape this distress that's coming upon the inhabitants. As with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him. Now, you know, in times of invasion, it's very often found that those that do have extra are those that receive the greater vehemence of the opposition, of the invading power. In James chapter 5, there's an interesting little statement which illustrates that. James chapter 5, go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. This is a prelude, I'm sure, to AD 70. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. You have heaped treasure together before the last days. Behold, the hire of the labourers who have ripped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, the Lord of judgment and armies. So there, their wealth was an attraction for divine wrath, and perhaps too for the Roman wrath, because of course when an army goes to battle, they love to take home the spoils of battle. So they don't go looking in the little homes, they look in the big homes, don't they? They look in the wealthy homes, the homes of the masters and the princes of the land, because there, of course, there will be much more possession. Well, says Isaiah, whether rich or poor, male or female, master or servant, that you're not going to escape that which is coming upon you. Now, I want you to notice in verse 2, my dear brothers and sisters, and a question, perhaps I'll put it in the form of a question. Does that mean to say that there's going to be an economic depression before the coming of Christ? I say that because sometimes people quote this verse, don't they? And they use it in that way. And I could never ever see why. It hasn't got anything to do with that, has it? It hasn't got absolutely anything to do with it whatsoever. I don't know why it ever was used in that way. But you hear people sort of spout it off. As with the buyer, so with the seller. You know, economic depression right through. But it also says the maid and the mistress, the servant and the master. It's not dealing with trade as such at all. Trade in terms of a buyer and seller is just one aspect of the verse. The point of the verse is that all stati of life are involved. That's the point of the verse. And you see, the calamity which comes upon them in this verse is not before the judgment, but at the judgment. Tell me, what does the scripture speak about in the latter days? Is it going to be a time of littleness or a time of surplus? Surfeiting and drunkenness. That's right. Another expression. Can you think of another one? That one's Luke 21. Where's another one? In Luke. You know it well. Luke 17. You're the only one present tonight. What's Luke 17 say, David?
Five and seven. Mary will give
That's right. As it was in Sodom, as it was in the days of Noah. Were they without good things? Not so. Not at all. It's not going to be that, my dear brothers and sisters. Instability, yes, seeing the waves roaring. But certainly not an economic depression. The scriptures teach the opposite. Just one really good quotation. Ezekiel chapter 16. It's funny how little phrases get sort of spoken and get into our record, don't they? And then you look at them sometime later and you find that they don't really mean that at all. Ezekiel 16, verse 49. Mark, would you like to read that for us, Al? Ezekiel 16, verse 49. Have I got the wrong mark? Ezekiel 16, verse 49. Oh, sorry, there's two marks. Well, who's going to read? You read then, Mark.
Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, the fullness of others in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the Lord.
So that's the situation of Sodom, isn't it? Not economic depression. Our problem, my dear brothers and sisters, is not too little, is it? Our problem is too much in a world that continues to grasp. And it's as they're grasping and racing ahead for that, that they are taken by the judgments of God. And that, of course, is our warning. All right, now turning back to Isaiah chapter 24, we have in verse 3 a statement again which is frightening. It's all very well to read this, isn't it? But do you imagine Isaiah telling this to his people? The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled. And it's irrevocable. For Yahweh hath spoken this word. See that? The emphasis coming behind that is that this is not an offhand comment. I'm not saying this, said Isaiah, because I have pleasure in making up a story. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for Yahweh hath spoken this word. It is not my word, but his. You know, that's an emphasis in this chapter. Look at verse 19. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. They're very extreme statements. As a matter of fact, there's not a word in the Hebrew for the word utterly in verse 3. It's just that the verb is in its extreme statement. And so to put it into English, rather than say it is it emptied very much or something, it says it's utterly emptied, see? But the Hebrew word is the one verb which means emptied in the utmost sense. All right, so this is by divine decree. So that's inescapable. Now, how would you feel if you were listening to Isaiah say these words and there's nowhere to go, verse 2, is there? And it's going to fall upon all people. Would you like to be found in that circumstance, my dear brothers and sisters? It's an awesome statement, isn't it? Do not let us just sit there in the calmness of Wednesday night Bible class, but try to feel the anguish, the terrible anguish, which comes from this picture. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled. Now, in that Jeremiah chapter 4, we have a similar passage here which helps us a great deal. By the way, the word land in verse 4 is the word Eretz again. In Jeremiah 4 and verse 24, Jeremiah says this, and he's speaking before the Babylonian invasion. He's speaking to Israel. He's not talking to the clouds or to the world as a whole. He says, I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form. Just put in your margin there, tohu, T-O-H-U, T-O-H-U. It's not Japanese, it's Hebrew. Tohu, and void, bohu, B-O-H-U. and the heavens, and they had no light. And I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens were fled. Can you sense what this is saying? Where does this language have its origins? It's in the creation story, isn't it? This is a turning back of creation. And the expressions there, without form and void, is the very expression of Genesis chapter 1, where the earth was without form and void. And so the mountains, you see, verse 24, which in Genesis 1 came above the water, are now seen to be trembling and the hills moving. The birds that came in Genesis 1 are now, in verse 25, receding. And man that was created on the sixth day in Genesis 1 is now not there. And I beheld, verse 26, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness. And all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of Yahweh and by his fierce anger. For thus hath Yahweh said, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end. For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken it, I have purposed it, and will not repent. See, it was a decree of Yahweh. Neither will I turn back from it. Now, the helpfulness of this passage is that we can clearly see, there's Jeremiah using the natural figures of the earth and the mountains and the water and man and the beasts and the birds, using all those figures to speak to the literal nation of Israel, the nation politic. And he's saying, the world that Israel has developed, the Tebel, the inhabitable world which he has developed, will be dismantled as surely as the earth was found before God created. What he as creator has created in Israel, a heavens and an earth, the political heavens of the nation of Israel, he will dissemble and take it apart. So we have a very interesting use of the language in Jeremiah chapter 4. So we can understand, therefore, when we come back into Isaiah 24, why he is doing the same thing. He says the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, and he's meaning more than that, isn't he? He's meaning that the nation of Israel, in its primary sense, is going to be completely be spoiled. Now, the similar language in Joel chapter 1. Sorry, Kev. It sure is.
With verse 3, would you see that as applying to the time of return of Christ, because Christ is fitting in with the destruction of Israel by man? You see, you take Zechariah 14, for example, it speaks about half the city being taken in captivity, which obviously means there's a residue, speaks about the residue of people not being cut off. Now, what then is the situation of the children of Israel in the land when Christ and the saints come to Jerusalem?
See, well, only a third are left, aren't they?
But it's not a picture of complete desolation.
No.
It's Zechariah 14, whereas this is.
Well, can I just say, as an opener to that question, that you've asked the $64 question of the chapter, so to speak. To answer that is really to come to grips with the whole chapter. Can I just say what I think, Kev, now, and I haven't given all the reasons for this, but this is what I might help. What I believe in chapter 1, verse 1 to 12, I think that it is firstly speaking of Israel. I think its primary application was seen with Assyria, which was the invasion that was coming up, but it was not fully realised in Assyria, because Assyria didn't take the capital, see? But I'm sure that many would have seen, say in the last verse, Yahweh shall reign in Zion, and before his elders, before his ancients gloriously, they would have seen Hezekiah and so forth, fulfilling that in part. I'm sure that would have been the case. But it wasn't the entire fulfilment. I believe then it would have been secondarily seen in the invasion of the Babylonians, where it was more fully seen, correct? And I think that it then would have had its real application, its final application to Israel in the terms of the Roman invasion in AD 70. Right? Then I believe that we have a period in which there is songs found in the Gentiles, that little section in the middle, which is the redeeming of the saints and the remnant of Israel that have been faithful to God and accepted his son. And they are not worried about the old city, they've got a new city.
Then, oh.
That's right. You do. And see how the whole thing's integrated. Like chapter 27 here speaks of breaking off the branches, scattering them, and putting them back on again. So that all goes on. That's Romans 11, you see. And that's all the time of the Gentiles. So it's all sort of explanatory, isn't it? The Spirit has got hold of the sense of it and puts on chapter 27, which really fills in a whole lot of information, which wouldn't be apparent in chapter 24, would it? But chapter 27, you can see it. You can see the history of Israel in chapter 27. Eclipsed and scattered, like boughs broken off the olive tree and scattered, and eventually come back home again. Terrific chapter. But that's not included in chapter 24. And then in the final section of chapter 24, I think, Kevin, that this is latter day. I think that's Luke 21. Seeing you've got me completely sidetracked, I'm going to now give you a question, which I really want everybody to work on. Right? We're members of the Isaiah class, aren't we? Not just me. And here's a little project that I think you'll really, really enjoy. In Isaiah 24, I've got a pencil. If you're finding it hard, I'll give you some help with it. Give me a ring or whatever. But this is a really interesting project. In Isaiah 24, find all the verbal echoes to Luke 21. In Isaiah 24, find all the verbal echoes to Luke 21. You'll be astounded. Absolutely astounded. Our master went through this chapter tooth and comb. He knew every jot and tittle of it, knew the sense of it, the detail of it, the figures of speech and so on. So that's a thrill, isn't it? It's lovely to think we're going where he went as well. Of course, he went through all pages of the Bible, I know, but there's overwhelming testimony that he went through this one. And here's the second question. What about other chapters of Isaiah in Luke 21? All right. Do you want me to repeat that? What about other chapters of Isaiah in Luke 21? Now, we're looking at this language of earth and so forth being eclipsed as symbolic of the nation being eclipsed, aren't we? Would you like, as a second example, to turn to Joel? The one in Jeremiah is a ripper, but this one here in Joel is very good too. And notice, you know, that Jeremiah never had any hesitation about that language, did he? You know, today, if you had an interested friend, you'd have to spend half an hour to explain it to them. But he never had any question. He just said it. And they understood those terms. We were growing up more in those days, I think. Joel chapter 1, verse 4, more awareness of the scripture. That which the palmer worm, Joel 1, verse 4, that which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left hath the cankerworm eaten, that which the cankerworm hath left hath the caterpillar eaten. Nothing left. Utterly, utterly dissolved. Right? Verse 6. For a nation is come up upon my land, strong and without number. You see? They're the locusts, the caterworm, the cankerworm, and the caterpillar. A nation is come up upon my land, my Eretz, strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the cheek teeth of a great lion. Right? So there's the same kind of language. And we'll look at verses 7 to 10 later, in which the same kind of language is further used by Joel. So, coming back now to Isaiah chapter 24, there's lots of other similar uses of the same expressions. In verse 4, we have the earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world, and that's a different word, it's the word Tebel. T-E-B-E-L. Not Erex, but Tebel. And whereas that's used generally for land or country, this one has more the sense of the inhabitable. The inhabitable world. Or the fruitful world. The linkage between inhabitable and fruitful is that if it's fruitful, you can live in it. You can live in it because it's fruitful. See, that's the joint, the union of ideas. So, verse 4, the earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. Thus focusing more on the fact that he's directing the language to the people. It's not the earth itself that's not going to exist. Now when that's raised, you need to know this passage, don't you? Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 4. One generation passeth away and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. So he's not talking in verse 4 of the literal earth perishing or mourning and fading away. It will last forever. And concentrating then upon the sense of the people, the inhabitants themselves, the end of the verse says, the haughty people of the earth do languish. The haughty people of the earth thus draws attention to where the judgment is really going. It's not upon the land itself, but upon the people. Now, it is an interesting thing, though, that in time of invasion, the land does suffer dreadfully. Can you think of an example or two of that? There's some very dramatic examples of that. You ever read about Napoleon? They say that wherever Napoleon went, it was just like as if, you know, a whole lot of bulldozers had just gone straight through the country. There wasn't a thing left. All the trees were taken down for fuel and for laying siege and so on. He just ransacked everything, just went straight through like a great hurricane had gone through.
There's also a case here in Christian because of the earth policy was you would as the Jews retreated back to Jerusalem, so all the land was burnt, so there was no food for the Assyrians.
Is that so? I didn't know that. Where's the evidence for that, Peter? Or wasn't I supposed to ask that?
Go
on. That's very interesting. Well, who else had in the day of Napoleon, had a scorched earth policy? The Russians, didn't they? So they got right through and it was getting colder and colder in winter in 1812. And when he got to Moscow itself, there wasn't anything left. The city was in ruins. And so, yes, World War One. You've seen pictures of World War One in France, in northern France, where they fought for year upon year, just like this, within a few hundred yards. And all the country rounds, like a moonscape. Terrible, terrible times. In fact, when we were there in France in 1988, the bicentenary of the French Revolution, we saw vast numbers of new trees. And I asked several people, I said, where are the old trees? Because you could tell these were not 100-year-old trees. And France, of course, should have had many areas of great trees. But the fact was that war has taken them away. So they've had a great reforestation project all through France to bring the trees back. So, all right, yes, the land is affected by invasion. But God's judgment was, of course, upon that land, not because of the land itself, but because of the people themselves. The haughty people of the earth do languish. The high people, says the margin. The interlinear says the proud of the people of the earth. And of course that evokes, doesn't it, a theme in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2, for example. We've seen this many times, haven't we, in Isaiah, this declaration against the proud and the haughty and the high-minded. Isaiah 2 verse 11, the lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day. Right through down to verse 17, which repeats that. And my dear brethren and sisters, it's a day to read that, isn't it? When the Sodomites are prepared to go down the main streets of the greatest city in Australia and declare their infamous rights. And 500,000 people, so I'm told, turn out to look at them, and another 500,000 are home watching them on TV. My dear brothers and sisters, if there was nothing else told us we were in the latter days, that'd have to be it, wouldn't it? Frightening. And they want to take your child and mine at school and tell them that that way of life is okay. It's no wonder that we are very apprehensive for our children. Verse 5. The earth also is defiled unto the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, point 1. Point 2, changed the ordinance. Point 3, broken the everlasting covenant. Now, if you turn back to Numbers chapter 35, you have a reference to this defiling the land. What defiles the land? Does it enter into the soil? You know, if you ask people that today, they would say, well, a spillage from a factory. And they'd be racing around with all kinds of conservation means to try and prevent that. All right, that's okay, and it's a good thing. But you see, there's something that's far more defiling than that. Look at the hypocrisy of our generation. That could take place in the great city of Australia last weekend, and yet they'll be talking about aerosols and spillage from factories and put so much more concentration on that and give full credence to that. So the leaders of our nation on both sides suggest that's okay. Ah! They know not the ways of God, do they? Dreadful, dreadful behaviour. The hypocrisy. What defiles the land? Numbers 35. Verse 33, so ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. Defile not therefore the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I, Yahweh, dwell among the children of Israel. Or take again another similar passage dealing with the defilement of land. Jeremiah 3 and verse 1. They say, if a man put away his wife and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith Yahweh. Lift up thine eyes unto the high places and see where thou hast not been lined with. In the ways hast thou sat for them as the Arabian in the wilderness, and thou hast polluted the land with thy whoredoms and with thy wickedness. That's what pollutes the land. Evil, filthy living. Verse 8, and I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. It came to pass through the lightness of her whoredoms that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. That's what defiles the land. Now that's the first of those three expressions of complaint that God has in verse 5. Because they have transgressed the laws. They have defiled the land. And then he says that they have transgressed the laws. Change the ordinance. Now, we come back to Leviticus 26. We see the general sense in which the people had transgressed his laws. Leviticus 26 is like Deuteronomy 28. It's a long chapter reviewing the future of Israel. And the last verse perhaps sums it up and says, "These are the statutes and judgments and laws which Yahweh made between him and the children of Israel in Mount Sinai by the hand of Moses." And I believe that that's what it's referring to, that they had generally transgressed his laws. Change the ordinance or change the statutes is much the same kind of thing. And then it says, broken the everlasting covenant. Well, that I believe is a reference back to Genesis chapter 17. And it's the covenant of circumcision, which is described there as an everlasting covenant. So we have in Genesis chapter 17, verse 7, "I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession." Verse 10, "This is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised." They have broken the everlasting covenant. And that's very tangible matter, because the inheritance of the land is linked in Genesis 17 with that covenant that God made with them. So if they break the everlasting covenant of Genesis 17, then he is fully entitled to break his covenant which he has with them in keeping them in that land. Therefore, verse 6, "Hath the curse devoured the earth," Isaiah 24 verse 6, "therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left." When it says the curse devoureth the earth, I think your best reference there is Deuteronomy chapter 28, which is the chapter of blessings and of cursings. In Deuteronomy chapter 28 verse 15, after speaking of the blessings, he then says, "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." And again, in a similarly summarizing way, verse 45, "Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee and overtake thee, until thou be destroyed. Because thou hearkenest not unto the voice of Yahweh thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded thee. Therefore, as Isaiah says, verse 6, hath the curse devoured the land," the Eretz, "and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left." And so a doleful time without joy is found in the land. "The mirth of Tabray ceaseth, the noise of them that rejoice endeth, the joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song, the strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. And the city of confusion is broken down." That word confusion is the word tohu, which we had before in Jeremiah chapter 4, the word from Genesis chapter 1. And so the city that had been for light and for truth is now a city of confusion and broken down, and every house is shut up that no man may come in. There's a crying for wine in the streets, people longing to see some joy once again. All joy is darkened, the mirth of the land is gone, in the city is left a desolation, and the gate is smitten. But then it says in verse 13, just as a final touch, my dear brothers and sisters, "When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be the shaking of an olive tree," that is to say, a remnant. "And these," verse 14, "shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh, and they shall cry aloud from the sea," from the west. So people from east and west, in the time of Israel's dispersion, are found joyous in song and praise. And that is, of course, our opportunity to sing in the times of Israel's dispersion, when the blessings of God have been given to us. All right, we'll leave it there, and we'll follow through the chapter next time and see where it takes us. Thank you.